chose this topic because Shakir has done a lot of interesting work on the subject of reference frames and their role in quantum theory. Here are a couple of references on that subject. The first one is about how to lift superselection rules by building quantum reference frames. So that's part of my interest in the subject. But also, in the early 2000s, it became clear that reference frames had a large role to play in the subject of quantum information theory. And so that was the other way I got interested in this. So just to give you a sense of how that works, you know, here's an interesting problem in quantum information theory. If Alice wants to send Bob some information, and she encodes that information in whether a spin a half system is up or down along the z-axis, well, then if they don't share a Cartesian reference frame, Bob can't read out the information because he doesn't know what up along z is relative to Alice, so he can't get the information through. So one way to fix that is if Alice starts off by transmitting some information that can allow them to line their reference frame. So she might send him a whole bunch of spins which are meant to describe a triad of directions in space so that she can tell Bob, this is what I mean by up along Z and so forth. And so so if you do that, then you have, you know, some ability to later on communicate zeros and ones and quantum information as well. So the question came up, if the systems that you transmit to align your reference frames are, you know, bounded in size, what's the optimal state to prepare? What's the optimal measurement for Bob to do to get out that information? And so there was a lot of interesting questions about what makes a good quantum reference frame. You can think of the quantum state of those initial systems as the quantum reference frame, and, you know, what are the best quantum reference frames you can hope for? So this, by the way, has a different flavor of solution depending on what symmetry you're interested in. So the example I just gave was the example of a rotational symmetry, you know, so you're aligning Cartesian frames. But you could equally well talk about clock synchronization, if you like. So there, you're trying to set up a reference frame for time, and, you know, you want to transmit systems that tick and are non-invariant under time translations to try to synchronize clocks. Or you could be talking about the global positioning system, where you're trying to set up a reference frame for position. These are all different sorts of groups, and so questions about what are the optimal quantum reference frames are different in these various contexts. So there was a lot of work, as I said, in the early 2000s about this, and my two main co-authors on the subject, Steve Bartlett and Terry Rudolph, and I wrote a review paper on all that work, which you can see here, but that's now quite old. And in the intervening time, there's been a lot of progress on quantum reference frames, and so I want to talk about that stuff, not this older thing. And so the main thing that's changed is that in the intervening time, we've started thinking about quantum reference frames more from the perspective of resource theories. So in quantum information, the sort of paradigm example of a resource theory is entanglement theory. And the idea is this. You imagine that Alice and Bob don't have a quantum channel, and that's a restriction they face. So it's not a physical restriction. They could build a quantum channel, but it's a practical restriction. They happen not to have one. They only have a classical channel. And so they can do in their labs any quantum operation they like, but they only have this classical channel. And relative to that restriction, if somebody else gives them a pair of entangled states, then that's a resource for them, because they can use that, for instance, together with their classical channel, to simulate the use of a quantum channel. So they can consume the resource of entanglement to overcome the restriction of having no quantum channel. And so then in entanglement theory, you ask things like, can this entangled state be converted to this other entangled state? What are good measures of entanglement? And so on and so on. And so we want to take the same approach to quantum reference frames. We say, well, imagine a practical restriction wherein you have no reference frame. So maybe it's Alice and Bob again, and they share no reference frame, or maybe it's just a single person who happens not to have anything that breaks the relevant symmetry. So in that situation, the operations that they have available to them are all symmetric under the appropriate group. And then any quantum state that they're given which breaks that symmetry becomes a resource to them. They can start using it to simulate operations that break the symmetry as well. Okay, so that's the basic idea. And so the first paper I wrote on this was with Gilad Gur, and we were still thinking about the resource as kind of, you know, how good is a quantum reference frame. But most of the work I'm going to tell you about today is primarily the work of myself and my former PhD student, Iman Marvian, who's here. These are two of the main papers on the subject, and a lot of the results I'm going to tell you about are from these papers. But we made the transition of thinking, well, what is the relevant property that a quantum reference frame has to have? Answer, it has to break the symmetry. So the property is asymmetry or symmetry breaking. So you're really trying to figure out how much does a quantum state break a given symmetry. That's the relevant property for being a good quantum reference frame. Okay, so one of the motivating ideas, I always like to introduce sort of motivating principles, deep principles. So there's something which you may not have heard of by this name, Curie's principle, but which you're probably familiar with. So it says that any asymmetry that you see in some physical effect has to be found in the causes of that effect. So where does that come up? Well, you know, if you were a student in physics and you solved a problem and you noticed your solution broke some symmetry, and then you looked at the statement of the problem and the initial conditions and the dynamics, and the symmetry wasn't broken in the statement of the problem, you usually say, I must have made a mistake. Because if there's an asymmetry in the solution, it means that it had to be there somewhere in either the boundary conditions or in the dynamics. So I think we, as physicists, we kind of internalize this sort of principle. Curie used it in the context of crystallography. And I think it's a very fruitful principle. I'm going to be talking about a slight generalization of it, which is essentially a quantitative version of the principle. So the idea there would be that the measure of asymmetry in some physical effect can't be greater than the measure of asymmetry in its causes, not just the presence of asymmetry. Okay, but because this is a conference on concepts and paradoxes, I thought it'd be a good idea to start off with a paradox. And many paradoxes, in my mind, have the shape of, here's a deep principle that we think is a good principle, here's a concrete example that seems to violate that principle, that's the paradox. So here's a couple of paradoxes for you. Is the following a violation of Curie's principle? I have a column that's cylindrically symmetric, and I push on it until it buckles. So the final state seems to break the symmetry, whereas the initial state had cylindrical symmetry. So is that a violation of Curie's principle? So I don't want to hear your answers, but maybe a show of hands. How many people think this violates Curie's principle? Nobody. But one. Okay. I didn't bring an experimental apparatus.
Yes, but it will happen.
My press a column, it will buckle.
But you cannot make exactly symmetric apparatus. It will make exactly symmetric apparatus. You will not get
experts. Okay. So on those grounds, you think Curie's principle is not violated. Great. What about the quantitative Curie principle? Do you think? Let me ask that. Who thinks that this would violate a quantitative Curie principle? It obviously it depends. But you know, do you think that there's no way of defining a measure of asymmetry such that this could satisfy it? That's the question. Okay. So let me move on to maybe a slightly more vexing example, which involves a quantum theory. Say I have a spherical detector, and at the center, I prepare a particle that's in a symmetric wave function that's expanding. So the particle starts off in a totally symmetric state, and then I detect it at one point in my detector, but I do it in a way that the particle perseveres, right? It doesn't destroy the particle. But afterwards, the wave function of the particle is now localized to one particular region on the sphere. So it seems like the particle has gone from being in a symmetric state to being in a state that breaks rotational symmetry. So how many of you think that this is a violation of Curie's principle? Lev? A few others?
If you said that was the actual final state of your physical evolution, in a deterministic way, as opposed to one possible final state or one part of the final state, then I would.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that if I just consider the single case, the case of just having a particular outcome, rather than the ensemble of cases of all possible outcomes, does it violate Curie's principle in that single shot? Anybody else? Okay, wait, who thinks it violates Curie's principle in the single shot instance? We don't have room for discussion. But if you think many worlds solves it, leave your hand down. Okay. So I'm going to come back to these paradoxes.
That's the practical test. How do you time reverse it? Because you want it to go back to the center. And that's it.
This is not about time reversal. This is about whether the symmetry is broken in the final stage versus the initial stage. I disagree. All right. In any case, we can have these discussions at the end. So I'm going to come back to these paradoxes later in the talk, after I've developed some of this framework. Okay, so I want to tell you about this resource theory. So I have to start by defining what I mean by this set of operations that define the resource theory. So you think of these in any resource theory, these are the set of operations that are given to you for free. You can do these as much as you like in any quantity. So in entanglement theory, you're allowed to use as much classical communication and local operations as you like. In the resource theory of asymmetry, you're allowed to use symmetric operations as much as you like. Okay, so what are the symmetric operations? So first of all, you have to tell me what the symmetry you're interested in is. So if you're interested in rotational symmetry, for example, then the group is SO3, and you need to provide me with the appropriate unitary representation of that symmetry. So for example, if you're describing a spin half particle and you're thinking about SO3 as rotations in space, then you get one unitary representation. For integer spin particles, there's a different unitary representation. So you specify all that, and that tells you what symmetry you're talking about. And then if you consider the most general sort of operation, which is not just the unitaries, but the completely positive trace-preserving map, you just demand that they commute with the action of the group. And that's what I mean by a symmetric evolution. And this includes, in particular, the case of maps that have different dimensions of input and output spaces. I can define them to be symmetric this way as well. So pictorially, this map E is symmetric if, for all elements of the group, it commutes with the action of the group, which means it doesn't matter whether I do the action after E or before E, I get the same thing. Okay, and this swirly colored pattern is going to be my way of representing things that are symmetric. Okay, good. So here's an example. If I consider the map that takes the block sphere of a spin a half particle and it contracts it, intuitively that seems like it's rotation symmetric. And sure enough, if you imagine doing that and then following it by any rotation in space, you get the same thing as if you did the rotation and then you did your depolarizing channel. So it satisfies the definition. Okay, as an aside, this is not just a mathematical definition. It turns out if you give me any symmetric operation, I can always implement it in the following way. I can take my system, couple it to another system, an ancilla, which is prepared in a symmetric state, via some unitary that itself is symmetric, so commutes to the action of the group, and then trace over the ancilla. So there's always a way for any symmetric operation of implementing it this way. It's a version of the Steinspring dilation theorem. So if you give me one of these things, it's always possible to implement it. And so in particular, if you take my example of the depolarizing map on a spin, if I have an unpolarized bath of spins, and I couple my single spin via rotationally invariant Heisenberg interaction with that guy, I can achieve some depolarization, which is rotationally symmetric. Okay, so one of the questions that any resource theory wants to answer is, what are the conditions for deterministic state conversion? So what are the conditions for some quantum state rho to be able to go to sigma under some symmetric operation? Meaning, so there exists some symmetric map which applied to rho gives me sigma. And so there should be some conditions on rho and sigma that'll tell me whether or not this is possible. So phrased that way, this problem should remind you of a result in physics, which is Noether's theorem. So let me remind you what Noether's theorem is. So Noether's theorem, and here I mean it in the general sense of, you know, any result that connects a symmetry in the dynamics to a conservation law. In the quantum context, it says that suppose you have a particular symmetry with some generator L. So if it's rotational symmetry, then L will be the angular momentum operator. Then if some unitary V commutes with that group action, it means that V also commutes with the generator. And therefore, if I can reversibly convert rho to sigma, so if V is a symmetric unitary that takes rho to sigma, and the inverse of V takes sigma back to rho, then I can conclude that all moments of this generator L are conserved in this transformation. That's Noether's theorem. And so you know the standard story for different kinds of symmetries. You get different kinds of generators that are conserved. Okay, so this theorem has actually two deficiencies from this resource theory perspective. The first deficiency is that it tells you absolutely nothing about the consequences of open system dynamics. It refers only to these reversible closed system unitary dynamics. But as we just saw, it is perfectly fine to define an open system dynamics that has the symmetry properties. So what can we say for those kinds of dynamics? And the second thing is that even if you restrict your attention to closed system dynamics, it turns out that Noether's theorem doesn't capture all the consequences of the symmetry. There are further constraints. Okay, so that's one of the things that we've shown in our paper, and I won't have time to go into that today. You can ask me about it later if you like. But I'm going to focus on fixing the first problem. So for that, I want to define a measure of asymmetry. So this is, again, something that you do in general resource theories, define measures of a resource. And this is how it works. So a measure of asymmetry is any function A from quantum states to the reals that has the following property. If rho can be converted to sigma by symmetric operations, then A of rho is greater than or equal to A of sigma. Okay, so it's defined as something that is non-increasing under the free operations.
Yeah. Let's think about it.
Actually, if Jeff, why don't you leave it and the operator will fix it. Operator? Hello?
Yeah, the room is automatically shut down at 5, so I just have to restart everything for you.
Okay, thanks. why don't I continue, and we'll just do it without slides for a while. All right. So remember the definition that A is a measure of asymmetry if it's non-increasing under symmetric operations. So in general, if you have some irreversible dynamics that takes rho to sigma, then what you're going to get out of measure asymmetry is a monotonicity constraint. It's a bit like the second law of thermodynamics. It says, here's a quantity that's not going to increase under symmetric operations. But if you tell me that the interconversion is reversible, so rho can go to sigma by symmetric operations, but sigma can also go to rho by symmetric operations, then if A is a measure of asymmetry, the inequality goes both ways, and now it's an equality, and every measure of asymmetry defines a new conservation law. Okay, so if you have measures of asymmetry, you get conservation laws for reversible conversions and monotonicity constraints for irreversible ones. So then the question becomes, if you look at these Noether quantities, which are the moments of the generators of the group action, are they good measures of asymmetry? Are they non-trivial measures of asymmetry or not? So what do you think, given that I don't have any slides? Good guess. Yeah, they're not. So the basic idea of why they're not is something that I can prove more easily with overhead. There we are, perfect timing. Okay, so the answer is no. And the reason is that if I take some particular group action with generator L, and now I consider two states, the first state is something which is diagonal relative to the eigenspaces of that generator. So these L's are eigenstates of the generator L. And a second state, which is a coherent superposition of those eigenstates, then these clearly have different measures of asymmetry. Why? Because this guy is completely invariant under the group action, right? It's only going to, because it's diagonal, the phase factors that get picked up by these guys don't influence the state, whereas here I can change the relative phases of those different states, and so the state actually changes under the group action. So this guy's asymmetric, this guy's symmetric. Any measure of asymmetry, any non-trivial measure of asymmetry, should be able to tell the difference between the two, so this guy has off-diagonal elements in this basis, that's the key thing. And the problem is that none of the functions of the Noether's quantities can tell the difference because these expectation values depend only on the diagonal components relative to this generator. Okay, so these guys are not measures of asymmetry, no function of the Noether quantities are measures of asymmetry. So that brings us to the question, how do we define measures of asymmetry? And this is where information theory comes to the rescue. So one of the themes of this talk is going to be that we can learn a lot about quantum reference frames by thinking about quantum information theory. So here's the key result that's going to, sort of all the results I tell you about are really going to come from this simple lemma, which essentially makes a connection between problems of constrained dynamics and problems of information theory. So over here on the left, we have the problem that we're faced with, which, you know, does rho go to sigma by some symmetric operation, which I portray this way. And it turns out that it's equivalent to this problem. Is it the case that every element in the group orbit of rho can be mapped to the corresponding element in the group orbit of sigma by any operation at all? Okay, so you know, here you imagine taking rho and doing every possible rotation on it, and then asking whether I can turn that to the correspondingly rotated version of sigma by some operation. Okay, so the sense in which they're equivalent is that if rho goes to sigma by symmetric operations, then it's possible to take the group orbit of rho, the group orbit of sigma by some operation, and vice versa. And to make this plausible that it could be true, note that over here you have an easier problem. You're taking a single state to a single state, whereas here you have to take a whole ensemble of states to the corresponding element of another ensemble, so that's a harder problem. But over here, you have the advantage of being able to use any operation, whereas here you're restricted in the sets of operations you can use, only the symmetric ones. So that kind of balances out. Okay, so it's not hard to prove the truth of this lemma, just given the definitions, but it's, I think, better, instead of seeing the mathematical proof, to get the physical intuition for why it's true. So we're going to give you the physicist proof. And it goes like this. It basically corresponds to the fact that these two problems I've just defined for you are the same problem described from two different reference frames. Okay, so here's the problem. We have Alice and Bob. They don't share a Cartesian frame. And Alice prepares a spin or some system in the state rho relative to her frame. She sends it over to Bob, who's supposed to do some operation on it, and send it back to her. And the task is that she should find it in the state sigma relative to her reference frame at the end. So from her perspective, the operations Bob can do, because Bob doesn't share a reference frame with her, she says, well, whatever operation he does, it's going to be rotated relative to that same operation had I done it in my lab. But furthermore, I have no idea what that rotation is, so I'm going to average over all rotations. So from my perspective, it's just going to be a symmetric operation, the averaging of all overall rotations. So from her perspective, it's can rho be transmitted to sigma, be converted to sigma by some symmetric operation. That's how she describes the problem. But now you look at Bob's description of the problem. He says, well, Alice is going to send me some state prepared relative to her frame, but I don't know how her frame is rotated relative to mine. So maybe it's oriented the same way as mine, in which case she's preparing rho, but maybe it's rotated by theta relative to mine, in which case she's preparing this unitary rotation of rho. So he imagines that there's one of an ensemble of states that's going to be sent to him, and his task is to return the corresponding element of that same ensemble to Rob. Alice. But now he can do any operation. Because it's relative to his reference frame, he's got no restriction on the operations he can do, so he describes it as the right-hand problem here. So that's the proof that they really are the same problem. Okay, but what it means now is that you've converted the original problem into one of information theory. So the sense in which it's an information theoretic problem is that this set of states can be thought of as a quantum encoding of a classical variable, namely a variable that runs over the group. Right? So let's say I want to encode information about a group element. I then prepare one of these states, the corresponding state, to encode my information. And then the question becomes, is the encoding that uses sigma as its base a better or worse encoding than the encoding that uses rho? So this is an information theory question. Can this encoding of the group be translated into this encoding? Well, if this encoding is better, it has more information, then there's no way I could do this conversion. So I think a classical analogy is useful here. So if instead of quantum states I was thinking about probability distributions over directions on a sphere, then I could, consider two different encodings. Let's say I have a set of distributions corresponding to every one of these directions. So this is a distribution that would pick out Z, this is a distribution that would pick out some other guy. But here's another encoding. It's a wider distribution for each one of those angles. Well, clearly this has less information because these two distributions are harder to distinguish. So this is a worse encoding than this one. I can go from here to here, but I can't go back. That's a problem of information theory. But this bridge principle allows me to take solutions of problems of information theory and convert them directly into solutions of these constrained dynamics problems. So that's what we're going to do. In particular, if you have a measure of information, the information about the group that's encoded in this orbit of rho, then it immediately turns into a measure of the asymmetry that the state rho has. And so now you can leverage all the known measures of information that people have developed in quantum information theory to define measures of asymmetry. So basically, we did that. Here's just a sampler of some nice measures of asymmetry you get out of this sort of approach. So if you start on the right-hand side with something called the Holevo quantity, you get this measure of asymmetry. It says, calculate the von Neumann entropy of the twirled version of rho. So the twirling map is one that averages over all the group elements of rho with some particular weighting. So this could be the uniform measure over the group, or it could be some other measure of the group. This is really a family of measures, depending on which measure of the group you put in here. So you take the entropy of this twirled version of rho minus the entropy of rho. That gives you a measure of asymmetry. So it's intuitive, because if rho is already invariant under the group action, then when I twirl it, it's not going to change. So the entropy of the first term is the same as the entropy, and I get zero. It says it has no asymmetry. But if the state is already very asymmetric, then when I average over rotations, it becomes much more mixed than it started as. And so the measure comes back as, yes, this is highly asymmetric. Here's a second example. If you start with the measure of information corresponding to the distinguishability measure corresponding to the one norm, you get this quantity. So it's just the commutator of rho and the generator of the group action, and then you compute the one norm of that. So again, as we talked about earlier, asymmetric states necessarily have off-diagonal elements relative to the generators of the group action. And so, whereas something like the variance over L, can't tell you whether the spread over L is coherent or incoherent, the fact that L and rho don't commute should be an indication that this thing has some asymmetry, and therefore there should be some norm relative to which this is a measure of asymmetry, and sure enough, the one norm does it for you. So this can measure asymmetry. And then finally, there's this peculiar one. If you start with the Renyi relative entropy as your measure of information, and there's actually a family of them. So if you start with the order S relative Renyi entropy, then you get this measure of asymmetry. So it looks a bit like the variance of L, trace rho L squared, but instead of having rho here, you have rho to the S and rho to the 1 minus S. And so if rho is invariant, then it commutes through the L's and it goes to 0. If rho is pure, this reduces to the variance over L, which is right, because when rho is pure, you expect the variance over L to tell you something about its asymmetry properties. But the really nice thing is that in between, this thing is non-zero only if you have some coherence. So it measures really the coherent spread over L, and it can distinguish what the incoherent and the coherent spread and just pick out the coherent spread. So these are all good examples of measures of asymmetry. Okay, so now can we rehabilitate Noether's theorem and say, what are the conditions such that rho can go to sigma under symmetric operations? So first of all, let me point out that if you thought that there was maybe some, ultimate measure that would answer this question, you'd be mistaken, because if you organize all the states in terms of an order relation where the arrow means rho 1 can go to rho 2 by some symmetric operation, then what you find is that they form a partial order. It's not a total order. So there will be states like rho 2 and rho 3 in this example such that I can't go from one to the other or back by symmetric operations. And that immediately means that there's no single measure of asymmetry that can tell you, that can answer the question of whether any two states can be converted. Because relative to one measure, rho 2 will be, more asymmetric than rho 3, and relative to another measure, rho 3 will be more asymmetric than rho 2. And that's what tells me, ultimately, if I have both those measures, that's what tells me that rho 2 and rho 3 must be not ordered in the partial order. And therefore, I really need many measures if I'm going to sort out what the actual partial order is. And this is the fundamental thing. That's sort of all the information is in this partial order. And so what you really want is a complete set of measures that allow you to characterize exactly what the partial order is. Now, over on the information theoretic side, there's a similar problem, which is if I have ensembles of states, there's a partial order that's induced by just data processing. And so the question is, do we know the conditions under which we can, do we know this partial order? And currently, we don't know how to solve this problem in quantum information theory, and we don't know how to solve this problem in asymmetry theory either. So we don't have an answer yet. We do have some progress. So if you're just talking about pure states, so Iman and I have solved that case. And this is the condition. It involves these characteristic functions. So it's just the expectation value for the group, the unitary representation of the group. This is just some arbitrary one-dimensional representation of the group. And this reminds me a lot of Yakir's modular variables. And so I've often thought that there ought to be some connection between these characteristic functions we use and modular variables. But that's just a side note. Anyway, so it's solved for the pure case, but in general, we don't know how to solve it. And so that's sort of an open problem, finding these conditions. Let me make one final note here, which is that the principle that sort of makes it clear that, you know, by data processing, you can't increase any measure of information is that, you know, information is ultimately defined as, you know, how much... How well can I guess what was put into a channel, right? So if I'm trying to send you a direction in space and I sample from one distribution or another and you just get the sample and you try to infer what direction I was trying to send you, well, any processing, you know, along the way that tends to, you know, change the distribution to one that's wider, you can't do anything about it. You're now faced with less information about the direction that I was sending you. And that's the sense in which data processing will always reduce your information. If I add noise, the distinguishability is just gone. So under this bridge principle, Curie's principle comes out as just a consequence of this data processing fact. So it's a very, I think, unavoidable fact. If you do things in this way, measures of asymmetry become measures of the information that's encoded about the group, and Curie's principle, even the quantitative Curie's principle, it just comes out as a sort of result of this general principle that you can't increase your information by data processing. Okay, so let me return to paradox number one now. So is it a challenge to the quantitative Curie principle? Well, under the way I've defined things, a measure of asymmetry is a measure of information about the group. So I would have said, you know, in this case, if I have a classical column, there was probably some defect which determined what direction it broke in. Maybe some, you know, small atomic defect. And then the only thing that would suggest that, you know, maybe it violates the quantitative Curie principle is if you thought that somehow the final state had more information about direction than that initial state did. But ultimately, a single atom serves to pick out a direction in space just as well as that broken column does. You know, at the end of the day, the broken column also has only sort of one atom's width of resolution on direction. Anyhow, so at the end of the day, you haven't increased the measure of asymmetry relative to the way we've defined it here. So it is not in conflict with the quantitative Curie principle. Okay, so now I'm gonna run through a few examples of applications of these sorts of measures. So here's an application in terms of noise limits in quantum amplifiers. So there's a lot of results out there that say if you try to build a quantum amplifier, you have to add noise. And most of those results start by doing a model of a very specific amplifier, like maybe it's a phase invariant amplifier in optics or something else, but they're really dependent on the details of those models. So what we have here is a way of deriving such bounds that really only require you to specify what the symmetries of that amplifier are and nothing else about the details. So here's an example. Suppose I'm trying to amplify angular momentum. So I start with a spin a half particle and it's going to spit out a spin j particle, okay? So I want to know, can I go from rho to sigma under rotationally invariant operations? Well, if I plug in my Holevo asymmetry quantity with respect to some measure over the rotations, I get this inequality. And if I rearrange it, I get this. It tells me that the entropy of the final state sigma minus the entropy of the initial state rho is lower bounded by this quantity, right? So if rho was a spin a half, then as I do an average over all rotations, the entropy of that thing is about one bit. If sigma is spin j and I do an average over all rotations, then the entropy of that is about log j. So this lower bound is about log j. And it says, okay, so you're going to have to inject entropy equal to log j if you want to do this. And the intuition is obvious that, you know, if a spin a half particle could be amplified to a pure spin j particle, then it would be able to encode a lot more information about direction. So it would say I could start with something that only had a limited amount of information about direction and end up with something that had a lot more information about direction. That's clearly not possible. So the way to make it work is by adding noise, make it a much more mixed state, and then it encodes as much or less information about direction, and you're done. But the point is that this can be done generically for any kind of amplifier you're interested in. What about quantum metrology? So here you've got something like maybe a magnetic field. You're trying to measure the strength of that weak field. So you send in maybe a magnetic dipole, which is prepared in some rotationally asymmetric state, and you let it get rotated by the field. And so obviously, if you want to be sensitive, you want this thing to have as much asymmetry as possible. You want the different rotated states to be as distinguishable as possible. That's exactly the definition of a measure of asymmetry. So you expect that your performance should be dictated by measures of asymmetry. So there's been a lot of work, I think, in the literature about how, you know, maybe entanglement powers quantum metrology. No, it's asymmetry. Asymmetry is the property that's relevant for quantum metrology. So we should all be using the resource theory of asymmetry to analyze metrologic tasks. So if you go in particular for this figure of merit, so people like to look at the variance in the unbiased estimator of a phase when you're doing phase estimation. Well, you can show through something called the quantum Kramer-Rau bound that it's upper bounded by this quantity, which is precisely that third measure of asymmetry I showed you for the order s equal to 1/2. So indeed, you know, these measures of asymmetry put limits on how well you can perform in these metrology tasks, which is what you'd expect. In this example, if I'm doing, for example, phase estimation in optics, L would be the number operator. If I'm doing rotations like my magnetic field example, it would just be the J dot Z, where Z is the axis of that thing I'm trying to estimate. Quantum speed limit. So this is another connection with Yakir's work. So there are some nice old results on ways of interpreting the time-energy uncertainty relation in terms of the time it takes for a state to evolve to another state that's orthogonal to the initial state under a given Hamiltonian. And so that's what this tau perp means. It's the time for rho to go to an orthogonal version under some Hamiltonian. And you can show that that time is lower bounded by 1 over the variance in the energy for that state. And it's also lower bounded by 1 over the difference between the expectation value of energy and this E min quantity, which is the smallest eigenvalue of H for which rho has some support. Okay, so these are two famous speed limit bounds. They're called speed limits because if I take the inverse of this time, that's sort of a speed of evolution, and I get a upper bound if I take the inverse of the left-hand side. So that's the sense in which it's a limit to how quickly they could evolve. So the problem with these guys is that if they work nicely for pure states, but if I move to mixed states, they're very terrible bounds. Like if I have a row that is incoherent over energy, then I know that it's never going to change at all. So this time is going to be infinity. That's clear. But this bound doesn't tell me that this has to be infinity. It just tells me, oh, look at the variance in the energy basis, and that's the best I can do. So clearly there ought to be better bounds. And that's what these measures of asymmetry can do for you. So the first thing we can do is point out that you can define a speed of evolution as a measure of time translation asymmetry. Ultimately, what does it mean for the speed at which something evolves to something distinguishable? It's a question about how different does it become under time translations. That's what we mean by time translation asymmetry. It's, it becomes different to itself under time translations. So if you give me any old measure of distinguishability of states, d, and some threshold epsilon, I can just define a time, the minimum time, such that rho of t is epsilon distinguishable from rho of 0 relative to your measure of distinguishability. So there's the formal definition. And if it so happens that it never becomes distinguishable from itself because it's invariant, then I just let it be infinity. So the left-hand side is now redefined as a measure of time translation asymmetry. And then you can show that you can find bounds where the right-hand side are just other measures of time translation asymmetry. So in particular, the second measure I showed you, where the generator now is the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is the generator of time translations. So I can lower bound this quantity by 1 over that measure of time translation asymmetry. And this other skew information measure of time translation asymmetry provides a lower bound if my measure of distinguishability is now the Renyi entropy rather than the L1 norm. Let me mention that these have very nice interpretations. So for example, this measure of asymmetry you can work out is just the sort of velocity of change of the state rho at time 0. Okay. Whereas this guy here turns out to be the acceleration of rho at time 0. So just very natural quantities that make sense in these sorts of contexts. Okay, one more example. Maybe two more. Limits to simulating measurements that break symmetry. I got 5 minutes? Good. All right, so the question here is, can I take a state rho A on some system A and convert it into a measurement on some other system S? So imagine you have system S and system A. I prepare A in some asymmetric state, rho A, and then I do some fixed symmetric measurement on the pair of them in order to simulate a measurement just on S. which breaks the symmetry. So that's a lot like what we've been talking about earlier in terms of operations, but it's for measurements in particular. So are there any limits on how I can simulate asymmetric measurements in terms of asymmetric states? So I should mention that these symmetric measurements now are ones that if I do a collective group action on the inputs, it doesn't change. So that's the particular definition for measurements. So again, I just have this same bridge principle that if this is possible, then it means that there's some fixed measurement which, when I feed in anything in the orbit of rho A under the group, it simulates that same thing in the orbit of that measurement under the group. Okay, so you know, rotating things here will lead to a rotation there. It's the same problem. And then over here in this sector, you can recognize this as an example of what's called programmable measurements. I say, well, which measurement I do is going to depend on the quantum program that I feed into this fixed measurement here. So people study that in the context of quantum information theory, and they derive something called the no programming theorem for measurements, which says that it's not possible to do this unless all of these programs are orthogonal states. Okay, so that's the result. Let me persuade you that that's true. Suppose I was just trying to simulate either a Z-spin or an X-spin measurement using a fixed symmetric observation, but two different program states, phi Z and phi X. Well, then this fixed measurement has to be able to discriminate these states, plus Z, phi Z, and plus X, phi X. Those states should give the plus outcome. So it should, you know, whenever I feed in Z for this program state, this operator should say, yeah, you get the positive outcome, because it's supposed to simulate S sub Z, which should give the positive outcome on the Z up state. And whenever you feed an X up here, this guy should give the plus outcome, because it's supposed to simulate this. So these guys should give the plus outcome for measurement O, whereas these guys should give the minus outcome for measurement O. And now if you look at, say, this guy and this guy, well, the only way that the measurement could perfectly discriminate them, given that plus Z and minus X are non-orthogonal, is if phi Z and phi X are orthogonal. Okay, so the program states have to be orthogonal to make this work. Okay, so you can generalize that and show that all of these states for every element of this group have to be an orthogonal set to make this work. So you essentially need a classical encoding of the group element. All those different states have to be orthogonal to one another, which means that this guy over here, if it's a state which under the action of the group gets mapped to a bunch of orthogonal states, that basically means it's a classical reference frame. So it basically says, yeah, even if this thing has a finite amount of asymmetry, I need a classical reference frame to simulate it, which is kind of surprising. But you might recognize that as the content of the Wigner-Araki-Yanase theorem, which was one of our motivations for thinking about these sorts of problems. So this you could think of as a generalization of that theorem. And for example, if you want approximate versions, like if instead of feeding a classical reference frame, I feed a quantum reference frame here, then I can only do noisy versions of the target measurement. So again, the measures of asymmetry can tell you something about how well you can do in those cases. All right, well, let me wrap up. One final thing you should note is that if I do this symmetric operation, you know, where I have a classical or a quantum reference frame here and my system here, it turns out that you can show that the reference frame degrades. Like if you start using it to do measurements, it gets worse over time. A quantum reference frame degrades. And so in particular, you know, we did a numerical study for phase references with different mean numbers of photons in them. So we looked at coherent states, we looked at states that had an upper bound on the number, and we showed that as the number of measurements you do increases, the certain measures of asymmetry go down. The reference frame gets worse and worse the more you use it. And given that result, I can now tell you about this case here. So I have my S wave propagating, and it becomes localized. Well, the trick is think about your detector as another quantum system. I've got this spherical detector. Note that if it's going to act as a detector at all, it's got to break rotational symmetry. If it had no mark that said this is the origin and let's measure steridian angles from here, it wouldn't work as a detector. So by virtue of being a detector, it has to break rotational symmetry. So I had some asymmetry already there in the detector. So when this particle becomes asymmetric, there's a place where that asymmetry could have come from, the detector. And these results about degradation of reference frames shows that what you expect is if you do this over and over, you will start to notice that your detector is becoming more and more symmetric. It is degrading, and at the end, if you've done it too many times, it will no longer work well as a detector because it's become basically smeared over rotations. So there is, again, no challenge to either Curie's principle or the quantitative Curie principle in this case due to the degradation of reference frames. And that's where I'm going to end. So should I summarize or should I just stop? All right, so the quality of a quantum reference frame is captured by its asymmetry properties. That's sort of the transition from reference frame talk to asymmetry talk. The asymmetry of a state can be understood as its capacity to encode information about the symmetry group. That was sort of the workhorse of all of this stuff I've been telling you about. And this quantitative Curie principle ultimately is just a consequence of the very intuitive principle that information cannot be increased by data processing, something that information theory just goes without saying. And then finally, I hope I've persuaded you that this resource theory of asymmetry, like the resource theory of entanglement, is a very useful tool for lots of different problems in physics, and hopefully you'll have some ideas for where else it might be applied. So thanks for your attention.
Questions? So I'm sure that the real physicists in the room are going to ask you this question, so I'll grant that by saying, how do you understand spontaneous symmetry?
I don't know. That's on the to-do list of things to understand properly. My impression is that the term spontaneous symmetry breaking plays a lot of different roles in physics. So some people, I think, would even describe that experiment I showed you with the detector as an example of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So if that's what you had in mind, I would say, you know, I've just told you how it fits in. But if instead you're thinking about, you know, spontaneous symmetry breaking in the context of the Standard Model, for example, I would say it's, at this stage, I don't know.
You showed us three different measures for asymmetry. As far as I remember, there is an anthropic measure, which you did not include on your list, that's the relative entropy. So I remember maybe Gur or...
Yeah.
Is that...
Yeah, so I was an author on that paper.
...in terms of relative entropy.
Well, so it turns out that that first quantity I showed you, this one here, is the one that you get if you start with just the normal relative entropy and convert it to a measure of asymmetry, you get this guy. So it turns out you can also write this as the relative entropy of rho to the rotationally average version of rho. It's just an equality.
I'm not sure I understood your resolution of Curie principle with the detector.
Yes.
Put just 17 detectors symmetrically all around, with one resolution, or whatever, one of them will click, and this will be breaking of Curie principle.
May I add that there are already numerous detectors like that. If this is not a mirror, just whatever material, then each molecule there is a detector, and all of them detect or non-detect at the same time. So just adding to Les's
question. So, well, let me repeat my resolution. Take those detectors, give them a quantum model. Model the dynamics of the interaction between those particles and the detectors. Look at the final state of the detectors. Look at the measure of asymmetry of the final state of the detectors. You'll find that it has gone down.
No.
I'm just telling you to do the calculation.
I remember.
You don't have to believe me.
I remember your remark before about many words. If you remember?
Sorry?
I remember your remark about many words. Without many words, it cannot be resolved.
No, but I just told you how to resolve. You just have to do the calculation.
No, the calculation tells you many words.
No.
But they all will be slightly detected. They will be all in superposition of detection.
Look, nothing I said about that calculation involved many worlds in any way. I've defined a sense in which the quantitative Curie principle could be violated in terms of the measure of asymmetry of the final state being less than the measure of asymmetry of the initial state. So we have to be talking about that, first of all. So if you don't agree that that's the way we should assess whether Curie's principle has been violated, then we're disagreeing. But if you agree that, okay, yes, that's the question that needs answering, then all you have to do is do the calculation I just described, and you will find that the measure of asymmetry has not gone up. And that's the sense in which it's resolved.
You believe one of them will click?
Yes, one of the
ones that click, it's not the symmetry is broken, as the symmetry was before.
Because not all 17 will click. One.
So it sounds like you're not listening to me. I define a quantitative Curie principle in terms of whether these measures of asymmetries will increase or not. Did you understand that?
Maybe in the not all times you you tell I understand, but I think the talk was very coherent and very interesting for me. But now it seems kind of inconsistent. I believe that you have detector and the detector click in particular place, one of the 17, the symmetry is broken. I don't know, and whatever mathematics you put there.
The symmetry was already broken because the detector was in a particular orientation.
No, they were completely
all
symmetric.
No, no, but the fact, like, I had a detector with serial number 100257. It was here. That breaks the rotational symmetry. You did not prepare your detector in a quantum state that was in a superposition of all orientations. That was not your experiment, okay? Your experiment was a detector with a macroscopic device where it had little ticks on it which said, oh, this is steridian angle, pi over 4, etc. That's what your detector looks like. That thing has tons of asymmetry.
You believe that this, if I put marks, this will put a symmetry. And I will not put any marks, none of them will trick.
And
so to get one outcome, I have to put some marks on the detector?
The marks are just meant as a dramatic illustration of the fact that this thing breaks the symmetry. I agree that...
How come that not all of them break? All of them should click. And
let's,
you know, there's only one of them.
Save the resolution of this question for after and take a few more questions. John had one.
Joe Rose wrote a book on symmetry. And he, in the book, he has a chapter on the Curie principle, and he actually talks about the question. He said you might want to read what someone says about applying the Curie principle to that. So that's a parenthetical, but he states it slightly differently the way you do it. He says the symmetry of a cause must be at least as symmetric as the symmetry of an effect.
That's just the contrapositive.
Yeah, I know it's a contrapositive.
So it's logically
more useful to state it that way than the way you stated it. Is that more because?
It's logically equivalent, so I'm happy to state it that way, yeah.
Because he said that was the way Curie put it originally.
That may be, yeah.
I'll just say that the collapse theories give a very simple-minded answer, which is that the collapse equation, the modification of the Schrodinger's equation, depends upon a randomly fluctuating field in space and time. And if it fluctuates one way, you get this result. If it fluctuates another way, you get that result. And so the fact that that field is different is an asymmetric cause. And that's...
But one last question.
Just to make sure I understand you correctly. So you would say that any classical object breaks the symmetry because all the atoms in it are localized. But this is a correct way of understanding what you are saying. The detector is classical.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, let me give you a formal definition of something being having only classical asymmetry properties. Okay, so in some of our papers we talk about whether something has quantum asymmetry or merely classical asymmetry. And the definition is that if I do describe it by a quantum state, so think of classical mechanics as something which I could describe using the quantum formalism if I like, you know, just it'll mean that things are kind of more diagonal. So if I take that original quantum state and I apply the group action to it, I will find that all the elements in the orbit of that group action are orthogonal to one another. And so that's what it means to have only classical asymmetry. That it's like a classical reference frame. As I, you know, as I rotate it, it becomes perfectly distinguishable. All those different rotations. So in the case of a Lie group like rotations, because there's an infinite number of elements in the group, I need an infinite dimensional Hilbert space to build a classical reference frame. Which is why it's always an idealization to say I have a classical reference frame. You know, every real reference frame is finite. So I think, you know, your original question, you know, if something's built out of localized atoms, you know, is it a classical reference frame? I mean, not quite, because, you know, when you get down to the atom resolution, there's going to be a certain amount of indistinguishability. So I think it's going to be classical down to the resolution of a single atom, and then it's not going to act as a good reference frame anymore. You're going to need to, you know, squeeze, you know, for example, in that direction at the atomic scale if you want a reference frame that's better resolution of angle than a single atom.
All right, let's thank Rob again.